Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. And today we're talking, I think, mostly about wine.
Yes, it's very exciting.
Which doesn't hurt my feelings at all.
No, we need to hear from you. I mean, I think it's very cool. You just went on a work trip to France. And I was, you know, I was thinking, I think one of the fascinating things about how you go on these trips is how do you go about setting up all the appointments and how do you decide where you want to go? I mean, how does the whole process work? I know it's complicated and it takes a while. So
let me back up 1 second. I want to go back to four words. Work trip to France. Do you have any idea how I have to defend?
Well,
how I have to defend that it's work?
Mm-hmm. I do, because I've been with you, and I know how much work it is. I know it sounds goofy, but and I understand because people say that to me too. But in the end, what time do you get up and what time do you go to bed? Because you're traveling, you're tasting so much in a day. How many houses do you go to in a day? How many wines do you drink in a day? Or taste, pardon me. Taste and spit, yeah. By the way. Taste and spit
Since
in a
I'm
day.
Since I'm still alive.
It's a nice word to say, spit.
I do tend to expectorate. Avoiding your S word. So it depends on regions. You know, there are places. Here's the trick. Because on this particular trip, we were in Burgundy, we were in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, we were in Bordeaux. Very diverse. We're also in Drancon for one day, up in the Pyrenees. So if you want to go visit a grower in Drancon, and there are only two or three that you'd want to get to that were really made interesting, age-worthy, you know, top-notch wines, mm-hmm. It's the closest region is Bordeaux, and that's 2 hours. So, like, just to get to those growers is a bit of a trek back.
It's in the mountains, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's really a bit of a trek.
I mean, beautiful place, but it's a haul.
Oh, yeah.
In a place like Burgundy, the producers are small, and they have all kinds of little plots. So they produce all kinds of different wines from different plots and different villages, but they're all super condensed.
Mm-hmm.
So you may visit one grower, and then 100 yards away is another grower.
That's great.
But let's say this particular grower makes three levels of wine from one village,
mm-hmm.
and they have three plots in that village of, you know, that are village level, the two that are Premier Cru, one that's a Grand Cru, and then they've got the same or similar for three other villages nearby that they or their family have accumulated over time. So that you may think you could, the travel time's shorter, but you have to taste an awful lot more wine, which is not terrible.
No,
we take the time to try to visit really interesting growers. You know, I think the thing that's really interesting is, and I try to do when I take people to teach, is to find producers that are really emblematic of either a place or a style, and go when vintages are particularly interesting. And right now you have 16 and 15. Most people have either just bottled or in cask. And those are both very strong vintages, very different style. 15, and really in all three of those regions, they're similar vintages, which does not always happen.
Okay. Sure, because even though they're in the same country, they're not in the same region. The weather is different. They're affected differently. The vines are affected differently by the different...
Yeah, 2,000 plus kilometers last week tells you that they're in different places.
Definitely. That's a lot of kilometers driving and getting around. So when you... going back to the vintages, 15 and 16, what did you find about those vintages? What did you learn from tasting?
16, and it's... 16 in general in all three of those regions is more concentrated and has, and I'm talking primarily about red wines,
mm-hmm.
Good, because you visit all three of those regions. If you're going to invest, in some of our places or in stores, I mean, all of that side of the business, it's a question of how much you're going to invest in what kinds of wines that are going to have an interesting long life, that are going to make your cellar greater over time. That's a draw to the particular restaurant. But at home, I mean, you want the same same thing. I mean, I was going in the cell yesterday to sort some things out just in my house, and realized, oh gosh, I have a lot of Pumerol. Oh, of course I do. I like Pumerol. But anyway, to your question, 16 tends to be more concentrated, really good ripeness, reasonable alcohols, which with global warming are higher than they ever used to be, say 20 or 30 years ago, which is kind of a crazy thing.
Right.
That in our lifetime, I've watched that huge climate change. And the Italian winemakers were talking about it first, before the French. The French were a little bit in denial.
Okay.
They're just like, well, you know, the 80s have been through some great vintages. And this is in Bordeaux in particular. Because those producers are so large economically, a great vintage, and I'm using radio air quotes, a great vintage is one where you have really good ripeness, right? If we're warming up, you're going to get more ripeness. So where they had a big run of vintages in the 80s, that's kind of the first indicator. You know, through the 70s, the aughts, you know, you can count on one vintage every decade being really strong, usually. One being dissimilar style, but probably pretty strong. And the only decade that in Bordeaux was that had a bunch of strong vintages, you could argue the 50s with 59 and 55, but it had a bunch of duds. The 60s had 61, but a bunch of duds. And 64 and 66, you can make some arguments for. But the 70s, same thing. I mean, you're kind of like a little borderline, and then some almost non-vintages because of poor weather and being cold and never ripening. And then you get to the 80s, and all of a sudden, 81's okay. 82 is fabulous. 83 is reasonable. 85 is strong, classic. 86 is very strong in some areas. 88 is reasonable. 89 is very strong in some, you know, that so you have a giant change all of a sudden in that decade.
So when you're tasting, what's the point of tasting from the barrel? What's different about tasting directly from the barrel before the wine is bottled and then tasting from bottled wine?
Well, you're tasting things that are in an evolutionary stage, and you have to understand that evolutionary stage. It is a lot more consistent to taste things from bottles. But the earlier, I mean, for me, the earlier that you can predict what a vintage is going to be like, you can make more intelligent decisions about making purchases,
if that
makes sense.
Sure, of course.
And the quicker that you make a commitment, the more likely you are in a good vintage to buy something at an advantageous price or in advantageous conditions. I wanted to take a second. So we're live. You can call us 410-662-8780 or email us formalwolf@wypr.org. And we're happy to take questions on all kinds of things that are not wine.
Sure.
I've just gotten back, and Cindy wanted to.
It was a great trip you're on. It's exciting to hear about, you know, what you did and how it went.
I'll tell you one thing that's remarkable is just the taking people who have not been to some of the regions, going to Burgundy, where it's a lot of pretty small farmers. And it's one guy in a T-shirt in his cellar who made very small lots of a number of wines. That's the person that's going to, you know, to taste you through things, perhaps walk you through some of their vineyard sites.
I love when that happens.
Then you go to Chateau de Pop, where most houses are making one, two, maybe three wines, maybe four. You know, a luxury Chateau, which is a relatively new thing in the last 20 years. There's their classic bottling, a white in small quantities sometimes, a Côte du Rhône, a Côte du Rhône Village sometimes. And that's still kind of a very few person operation. And then to go to Bordeaux, and you go from a producer in Burgundy who's going to produce 3,000 cases in a year, and to Chateau to a producer that's going to produce on average, say, 8,000 cases in a year. And you go to Bordeaux, and these guys are making 40 to 100,000 cases a year.
Wow.
The estates are so much larger, and primarily they're making one, maybe two wines, period. So someone famous, Chateau Montrose, who was the first producer that we visited. The people that that business so much in Bordeaux, especially, has become the real estate business. It's amazing. The value per, you know, per hectare, per acre in euros is super crazy high. And the owners are largely incredibly wealthy people, especially in the Médoc, Pauillac, Saint-Julien, Saint-Estèphe, Pessac. And then when you get to Saint-Emilion, Pomerol, there are some big dollar guys. You get a few farmers still, and long-time family traditions over that way. But still, the production's so much higher than you get in some other regions in France. Taking people through for that first time, it's always interesting to see kind of their... Because they're just French names on a wine list.
Right.
You know, it's not that you know Régis Fauré, who's a kind of a joker who likes to blind taste you on some of his older wines.
Which is great.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most fascinating things about wine is all the people that are connected to it. You have these sort of miraculous things that live and tell stories about place and about season and about all kinds of things that have to do with their culture, but they're really about the person and the persons along the way that made all these little micro decisions that made whatever product it is arrive in the bottle that's there, and then it lives and evolves.
It's an interesting point that the region is so very different, because I've spent a lot more time in the Rhone Valley and Burgundy than I have in Bordeaux. Actually, I've only been to Bordeaux once, other than a backpacking trip. And it really is. It's fascinating. Well, and also it's just like going up to Champagne. I mean, that's a completely different, to me, thought process, because I never realized that Champagne houses bought from all the farmers. I always assumed that they grew their own grapes, and, you know, and there are some grower producers.
But. Yeah, no question. The other thing that I would say, they probably benefit more than anyone else from global warming, by the way.
Champagne.
As far as
because
ripening
they're so far
more
north.
Often.
Yeah.
Because
that makes
as
sense.
Far as ripening so often.
Of course.
Let me dig into an email real quick before we take a break. My wife and I both recently retired. We have both been big Pinot fans for most of our wine drinking lives. Something happened when my wife hit the life landmark of retirement. Now she's told me that she doesn't want Pinot anymore. Imagine the shock on my face when she said, I want an expletive Zinfandel. That's thanks for using expletive Daryl in Colombia. Now I love my wife very, very much, and I want her to be happy along with me during this beautiful time in our lives, but I know very little about Zin. Help, recommendations for good vintages and producers.
That's awesome.
And great destination Zin vineyard regions we should visit. So... I think, just to quickly address it, Zinfandel is a California grape. You see much less vintage variation there, and it's a grape that ripens an incredibly long time. There's still a couple of principal styles, although one style kind of dominates, that is sort of hugely extracted, big bruiser, spicy, almost porty sort of style that you see. And you see producers all over the state making that. But most famously in the west part of Sonoma Coast. And Martinelli is one of those. Turley is one of those. Mm-hmm. Those are the two biggest names that are the hardest to get. For me, the sweet spot in Zin, where the pleasure and the economics have a really beneficial relationship, is where you find sort of older producers that have excellent sites and they're not chasing 5 million points. But they have really good vineyard sites for the grape. Joseph Swan is one of those. Fritz is one of those. And these are bottles of wine that are $20 or less retail, that are a little bit towards Pinot as far as being a little bit more sheer. They're not quite as oily as some of the big guys and the most famous guys. But they're probably more balanced for food. And they have a lot of the joy of the fruit of Zinfandel. Mm. So
that's cool.
When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we're talking about wine. And we're taking your calls, 410-662-8780, or send us an email, formulawolf@wypr.org. And please give us a ring if you want to talk about the best wine you ever had, perhaps. All of that on more on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or send us an email, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we're largely talking about wine. And, you know, it's funny, and maybe I can be negative about things, but I'd love to hear people's favorite wine they ever had or the greatest wine they ever had or the story connected to it. But also, I hold resentment about some of the bottles of wine that I have purchased in the past that were sorely disappointing.
Uh-oh. Yeah, because you get so excited. You've made an investment. You're excited to open it, and you plan it. It's not, well, that's like today. I no longer have my cellar in my house. So I had to go get some of my wine because I have guests coming over later. And I was talking to you about it before we went on air. And you're like, oh, that's not the right wine for the food you're about to have. And I'm like, oh, great. So that's a problem, along with the fact that, or if I took the time to open some of those bottles and there was something wrong with one of them or I didn't like it, then I wouldn't have anywhere to go. I would be like, okay, we're not drinking anything today.
Well, don't drink something you don't like. It's not worth it.
Oh, I agree.
It's not that big of a deal. You know, I mean, frankly, and if you're getting it from a shop and you don't like it, you should just take it back to the people of the shop. If it's a reputable, supplier,
all right. Yeah.
They should stand behind the product they recommend.
Okay.
And the product that they offer.
Can we go back to your trip?
Yeah.
Just thinking about, one of the questions I asked you was, how do you set up the tastings? How do you go about doing that if someone, you know, wanted to attempt to do this?
Well, it's a whole lot easier now than it was, say, 25 years ago, honestly. The Google Map thing?
Oh, I know.
Unless you're south of Rome and Italy, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I remember trying to navigate back in the old days and, you know.
Yeah, and I'm figuring out where things are based on the history of the name of the road. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm so glad that there's such a thing as Google Maps.
it's a wonderful thing. You're going to get more out of the trip if you plan the time really well. Mm-hmm. And let's say you're going to Burgundy. It's not that hard to figure out village to village to village. Villages are tiny.
Sure.
So you don't want to set up one appointment at a grower in Gevrey-Chambertin town all the way in the north of the Côte de Nuit and set up another appointment an hour and a half later in Volnay, south of Beaune. It's going to take most of the hour and a half just to drive there.
Right. So figure out your timing.
Yeah. And be on time. I mean,
that's super important.
Allow yourself time and be on time. And this is someone speaking who's not been on time for a number of wine visits over the years. And you always
because
feel like
you can't
a bit
find
of a jerk.
It. Not doing it on purpose, but because we couldn't find it.
But it's a whole lot easier with this map.
Yeah.
Thing
these my gosh, I know that was such a stress back in the day. You know, I'm like, oh my god, because we knew we couldn't be late, and there you are trying to find a place. But yes, so you set up ahead. You speak to who do you call?
Well, you either call or send an email to the estate. Mm-hmm. If it's a very small producer, or to the importer. If it's a very small producer, you may want to reach the importer if there's an importer. If it's something from the States, it's an awful lot easier to get something set up. Most of producers in Europe don't have paid tastings, unlike some of the best-known producers in the West Coast.
Sure.
So that's a little bit nicer. But they also, you can't just walk into places for the most part.
No, definitely not, right.
You need to set things up in advance. Mm-hmm. And even if it's a call like the day before, first thing in the morning, If you go to a hotel that has a good concierge in one of those areas, they're going to be used to trying to call and help you with appointments. If you have a wine merchant that you work with on a regular basis, there's no reason that they can't. Sorry for the burden I'm putting on wine merchants today.
But they could help you, maybe.
Yeah, but they could definitely help you.
Well, and if you don't speak the language, that's the problem with emailing or calling. So you just brought up a good point, which is the concierge in your hotel. If you're staying somewhere with a concierge, that's got to be incredibly. And obviously, you want to plan that before you leave. You want to contact the concierge and then, you know, before your trip starts, say, hey, can you do this for me?
Besides very small producers in France or in Italy, especially in pretty often visited regions, let's say like Tuscany or Bordeaux, there's a lot of English spoken at different producers. But it's really, really fun to get to some of the smaller producers and some of the more obscure regions, honestly.
Yeah, definitely. Those are my favorite.
That's one of the most interesting things. You're just a little more immersed in the culture.
So what were some of the best tastings you went on this trip?
Ooh, there were a lot. It was super productive. And we had great vintages to taste. I mean, I think in Burgundy, we were in Nuit-Saint-Georges, actually in the village of Vougeot, right next to Nuit-Saint-Georges. And the producer's name is Britannia. And Eva Ray, who is she and her family, the owners, she's German. She moved there 20 years ago and has made a giant difference in the quality. They have great holdings. Mm-hmm. So they have a number of bottling from Vougeot as well as their Clos Vougeot, which is the most famous Grand Cru, and Nuit Saint-Georges. And that was, for young wines, a pretty brilliant tasting.
It's great.
And they produced a Grand Cru, a Clos Saint-Denis, that of the young wines in Burgundy that we tasted, their 2016 was probably the single most magnificent. It was really fabulous, and it's going to be a 30 or 40 year wine.
Oh, good. That's cool.
I don't know that it will
survive
that long because it's super duper tasty.
Cool. Britannia. And in Bordeaux?
In Bordeaux, most memorable visit was a visit with dinner at Les Carmes-Aubrion. Les Carmes-Aubrion, a lot of people have heard of Chateau-Aubrion, one of the first growths in Bordeaux. And right across the road from that, and this is sort of in and out of the city of Bordeaux itself in Pessac. Just across the road from that is not a classified growth that is super famous and qualitatively is usually the equal of Aubrion. And that's La Mission Aubrion. And then, of course, to make it even more confusing, there are five other estates named something Aubrion. But the sort of third one in that triangle is a much smaller producer, Les Carmes, C-A-R-M-E-S, Aubrion. And the young gentleman, it's a very nice parcel that has actually a lot of Cabernet Franc, which is unusual. The blend is usually Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot relatively equally in that part of Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of Cabernet Franc in that. It makes it a little bit more charming and a little more aromatic, and the Cab Franc does very well in certain parts of the soil. But that, as an aside, the wine producer, the wine, losing my English. The wine grower, Guillaume, used to be the winemaker at Chaputier in the Rhone Valley. Very talented young guy, and definitely a little bit of a maniac for blind tasting. So besides giving us a chance to taste the excellent new vintages from Les Carmes-Aubrion, we also tasted a lot of things with the meal there, blind, and that was super fun. And all kinds of obscure things from all over France.
What a
and
great
I don't
opportunity.
Get to do that often.
Yeah, that's so great.
Amongst those was a 1959 Les Carmes-Aubrion.
Oh, my gosh.
That qualitatively was probably the best thing on the table for that night.
1959.
So, yeah.
That's great.
And he's a fellow who produced six or seven 100-point, Parker wines, which, as far as the public caring about critics, that's the biggest deal for sure.
So can you describe what it means to do a blind tasting and how does that actually work?
So blind tasting means making a bottle of wine unidentifiable. I did one yesterday with a number of staff at the restaurant. So, and savvy people will know from the shape of the bottle something about what's inside of it. So one of the things you have to do is
take it out of that bottle.
You have to take it out of that bottle or wrap it up in foil. And you have your glassware waiting and you have that bottle waiting and you want people to have to taste it in a vacuum where it's a little bit like listening to music with the lights off. All of a sudden it becomes much more clear, right?
Yeah.
Because you're using less other senses. Well, this is, instead of using, all kinds of things that people are thinking in advance or things, the preconceived ideas about XYZ producer or XYZ grape, or wines from Germany or whatever it might be, you're forced to actually deal with what's in the glass and only on a sensual level. And that's super interesting. And I always will try to talk people through blind tasting so they're forced to use each one of their senses. They look for visual cues about the wine. They look for all the olfactory cues and what the structure of the wine is, what's happening on the palate, what the flavors actually are, what was the promise that was given on the nose that is or is not delivered the same or differently on the palate, and how does it finish. And
that's how you figure out the grape varietal, you know, something is indicating age.
You can deduce a lot, but you can also deduce yourself way out of the picture. And I've watched an awful lot of people do that.
Mm-hmm.
I've often, for myself, to try to be more successful with it, the less I am thinking, the more that I'm just taking in what's being offered, the more successful I am at very quickly getting to what
you're trying.
What's actually happening in the glass?
You're trying not to make any assumptions. Have your mind open as much as possible. That's what you're saying, right? Yeah, I get that.
Don't think about the person that's giving it to you and what they like or don't like.
Right, exactly. You know, that's true. There's so many things that can affect.
Because you're blind, so you look for.
You have to be. Clear,
you have
no
to
thoughts.
Use your senses.
I get it.
Use
That's
your
pretty cool.
And for me, being thoughtless is second nature.
God. Oh my God. It's so much fun to blind taste. I love it. I think it's just so fascinating. And it's just so much fun. And it's so much fun to hear, you know, especially if we do it at work because, you know, they're whatever, how many people are there? 18 people at the table.
Well, people always, they feel pressure like it's a quiz, like, you know, well, you're the best blind taster. So.
Right. No, it should just be fun to me. I love it. I love it. I think it's such a good way to learn.
Well, you have to be willing to not sound like a
well, you have to
idiot.
Worry. Yeah, not worry about
and so
that.
That's,
just
that's
say
never,
it.
I mean,
well, yeah,
I'm
no
confident
one be,
I'm going to be an idiot,
right.
So it's really not that difficult to deal with.
And no one should be yelling at anybody.
No. Anyway, got an email here from Will in Waverly. I'm learning, that's apropos, I'm learning more and more about wine, mostly a project of fun and hedonism.
Good.
Those are good projects. but I'm not sure how to tell if a wine will be good to age or not. I've had some older wines, and I like the flavors and textures, but can't guess if my favorite mid-level wine I'm drinking now will be good in 5 or 10 years. Any helpful pointers for determining life expectancy of wines in the $30 to $50 price range? This is actually a more complicated question than it presents as. Aging wine is great, and I love to do it. It's one of the things that, you know, we offer professionally, as well as it's something just that I do for pleasure at home.
Mm-hmm.
95, 96, 97% of the wine that's produced, white or red, is not at all produced to age. It's produced to be consumed in the relatively short term. So that's one. Two, the price point of something does not determine whether it's ageable or not. There are wines from that blind tasting at Le Carmorillon. There are wines there were two from the Languedoc, which is in the south of France, and a very modest region historically for wines, and especially for making wines at age. And they were very inexpensive. There's zero expectation. One was a red wine from 1985, Master de Mascassac, and one was a white from 2002 that were both super interesting and very well preserved and aged successfully that were no money when they were put in the cellar. And we also had a 1990 Bergerac, which is usually a joke-worthy region for red wine, not that far from Bordeaux, if you're a silly French wine person like me. So that you have to be looking for things that actually will age well. The West Coast in general, they're making a lot of products for right now. There are things that will tend to age more successfully. I always put some Oregon Pinot Noirs from certain vintages, honestly usually cooler vintages, in the cellar to age. 2011 right now, drinking very nicely. 2008, drinking really, really well. And there's not a ton of Pinot Noir that's produced on the West Coast that is drinking that well at age 10. It's sometimes things that are not that tightly knit that are higher in alcohol and very, you know, sort of, there's a high sucrosity sort of character to it. Those things tend to sort of crack up, if that makes sense.
Sure. That's one of my biggest fears with my cellar is, am I drinking things in time?
Well, and it's always about the conditions in your cellar, right?
Oh, definitely.
You need, it can't be bone dry. You need decent humidity. Otherwise, the corks dry out. And you need to have a cool temp that's pretty consistent. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but the changes have to be slow. And you got to keep below at least 65. Ideally, it's 55 where you want to stay in the cellar.
So what was it like to drink a wine from your birth year?
Well, usually it's horrendous. because that was born
birth year.
I was born in 65, which is a terrible vintage in an awful lot of the wine growing region known as the Earth. But I've been trying my entire life. I think it's really cool to drink a wine from your birth year, and especially like if you can do it on your birthday or something
right,
like that.
Of course.
So I've had an awful lot of birthday disappointments that have to do with wine. I've tried to open a lot of 65s over the years, and they've always been pretty lousy. And I did find Vega Sicilia. They're 65.
That's a good one to find. That's exciting.
Pretty universally thought of as the greatest red wine of Spain. Vega Sicilia Unico, their 65 is super. It's definitely the worst mature Unico I've ever had.
Oh, interesting.
But it's definitely the best wine I've ever had from my year.
Okay, all right.
Also on this trip, if one of my favorite Burgundy producers for red wines, Henri Gouges, G-O-U-G-E-S. Henri Gouges, whose son's now the winemaker, for a little bit of retirement fund, because he's known me for some years, came and took us on a cellar tour.
Which is great.
And pulled corks on a number of things for us, including one thing blind to me that was... that happened to be for my birth year.
That's so fun.
And
that's exciting.
I was sort of shocked. I thought it was going to be a 64 or 66. We're both...
Because you liked
pretty,
it.
Because they're both pretty decent years.
Yeah.
But...
64 is an excellent year.
Yeah. 64 is an excellent year for some things.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, when we come back on Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine, we're taking calls, if you like, about your favorite wine you ever had or a disappointing wine that you had or with questions. You can reach us on email, and I've got one or two emails here as well, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And when we come back, we'll also have a chef's challenge, a very kind, friendly chef's challenge. All of that and more on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or send us an email. I've got a couple of here. ForemanWolf@WYPR.org. Topic is wine and everything about it. And
yeah, if you have any questions, call in.
And I have a question here. What's the deal with cooking wine? I see super cheap stuff at the grocery store. Not here in Maryland, obviously, but I've also heard to cook with whatever you plan to serve with dinner. What are your professional opinions as chef and sommelier?
I cook with something that I think is good, but I certainly don't feel I need to cook with what I'm about to serve. So,
if you wouldn't drink it, you shouldn't cook with it.
I agree. Absolutely. I mean, it's the same philosophy we have towards any liquor that we use, too. If I'm using whiskey, I'm using a good one. Am I going to... with wine, use the best wine in the, ever? No, of course not.
If you're using cognac, you're going to try to use the rarest one that we have just to make me nuts.
That I do.
Yeah, you do.
I do it, but I only also use like an ounce. So, and that would be in Torino Fuqua, by the way. And what was it? Triomphe?
Triomphe.
Yeah. Really good in a...
More importantly, I have an email here. Email here from Joyce in Annapolis. It's so cool to get some insight from you all on the production side of wine. What would you say is the most important piece of information about a wine from tasting it in the place that it's made that you can't get anywhere else? I mean, I think, Joyce, I think you said it. I think it is being in the place that it's made. And it's not just that it's romantic to be in such and such a spot. It's... The map comes alive when you actually have to travel to the place. You see the differences between where the vineyards are on a Premier Cru slope and a Grand Cru part of the slope and a village level of the slope. You can see soil samples sometimes and get an idea of what is actually happening under the ground, which is...
It's priceless.
Remarkable. Yeah,
yeah, it really, I remember from some of our first trips when we went to Chateauneuf-du-Pape, and one of the winemakers has several of them have glass, they almost look like huge vases, with a whole shot of the soil down a couple of feet. So you've got rocks, galettes, what they call galettes at the top, and then the smaller rocks, and then whatever else is below there. I mean, that's fascinating to see, along with the fact that, you know, I mean, you know a lot about wine. For me, learning, it was fascinating to see that this small plot of land is all these guys have. That's all they get in Burgundy. Well, and it's just like, wow, that's like a couple of acres. I mean, it's amazing how the land's been broken up there.
The one great vintage a decade, those guys are dead. Let's go to the phones. Sandy and Severn. Go ahead, Sandy. How are you?
Hi, Sandy.
Hello. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Hear you just great?
Go for it. What you got?
Good. Miller Thurgau wine on the banks of the Rhine River near Speyer, Germany.
Your favorite?
My absolute favorite of all time. It was the meal. It was the yellow viands. It was everything. And the wine came from the German Rheinstrasse, which at the time was, I was about 10 miles away from it.
That's great. So the grape, the most common grape to see in the Rheingau is Riesling, and most of the famous wines from different villages are produced from that. Müller Thurgau is a pet of mine. I like that very much, especially as a summer wine. That's a different it's a different varietal. It's a little bit lighter, cleaner, almost entirely clear. It's almost like silvery in the glass. Mm.
Yes, and it was just perfect. Nothing since has ever compared to it.
Oh, that's a great memory.
If you want to find another grape.
It was a local vintner, too. It was a local vintner and had seen the grapes growing on the in the vineyards and everything else. It was just a magical, once-in-a-lifetime type of thing.
That's great.
The Rheingau is a beautiful place.
Thanks, Sandy.
Yeah, if people want to play with Müller Thurgau, there is a producer in the Alto Adige on the Italian side of the border from Austria. There are a couple that make excellent ones, and that's a very good place to look for those as well as the Rheingau. And let's go to Brianne in Baltimore.
Hi, Brianne, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm taking my inaugural trip to the Tuscany region next month, and I was just hoping for some insight into the best wineries, vineyards to visit and perhaps even stay.
Are you going to have a car when you're there?
I will.
Okay, that's great because you want to get around. Tuscany is huge, so you really have to kind of, if you're, and you're a red wine drinker, white wine drinker, both?
Red, good white, yeah, both.
Okay. There are a couple of different areas that you want to take a look in visiting producers. One, and the most famous one, is the Chianti zone. The area between Florence and Siena is the Chianina Valley. And that's where you find pretty much all the Chianti Classico producers. And a lot of the villages there, they're great. Fontori is in Panzano. Way up high from Castellina is San Giusto Rentenano. There are a lot of, Monsanto is an easy producer to visit. There are a lot of great Chianti Classico producers to visit. And I would strongly recommend going to one of those, especially a lot of those guys have been at it for 400, 500, 600 years. It's pretty crazy to see the history in the place. And Sangiovese is different and more aromatic there than anywhere else. So that's one. Montalcino, the town south of there and west of there, that's a little bit warmer region. Brunello is the name for a Sangiovese in that area. Brunello and Montalcino, that's a great fort town to visit. It's very cool just to like sit up in the square and eat in one of the restaurants. And it still should be very nice in October. And there are growers that you're going to want to visit, modern ones and sort of old-fashioned ones there. And there are many, many, many to get to. For a white and a really pet, cute town to get to, San Gimignano, which is not that far from the Chianti Classico zone. San Gimignano is famous for producing a white grape called Vernaccia. And I would get to that town, and there's a producer named Panizzi who's sort of head and shoulders above the other guys that I've seen historically. If you can get in to visit with those guys, you will find some brilliant white wine in Tuscany as well.
And we've been there in October. That is a beautiful time to be there. You're going to have a great trip.
Oh, great. Glad to hear that.
Good for you. Have a great time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course. Okay, so I guess it's probably time for...
There you go, Tony.
Oh, my God. Give me the chef's challenge.
Let's go,
first.
Baby.
Got my brand in Tuscany.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Yep, well...
All right, so local tomatoes. Well, today is probably the last day to... If you're getting ones today, you probably got them picked on Friday, and because this week is going
to... We have many days of rain coming to us, unfortunately.
Yeah, tomatoes are going to be clobbered.
I can't even imagine what's going to happen in my garden and everyone else's.
It's going to be clobbered.
Yep.
Local tomato, basil, thyme, oregano with buds, extra virgin olive oil, shallot, onion, garlic, capers, lemon, lime, peaches, goat cheese, frog's legs, rice, butter lettuce, zucchini, radishes. Well, I'm going to want to make a salad with the tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to pickle the oregano buds, and with some of the lemon that's there. Mix them with the capers and a little bit of the shallot, and hopefully I have a little bit of red wine vinegar around to do that with.
Sure.
And that little bit of a pickled garnish is going to be fun to have with the goat's cheese and the local tomato. For that salad, just dress it with extra virgin olive oil. Besides that, the peaches, it's the last of the peaches. I just want them for dessert, honestly.
Mm-hmm. What would you do to them if you had some other ingredients?
Honestly, what I'd like to do is make basil oil and slice the peaches thin, serve us in basil oil, and if I had a little bit of spicy salami.
I love that. I love peaches with a good cured meat.
Yeah, because when it has
so
a
good. Like, great compliment.
Like a little salami picante with a calabrian chili or something in it.
That would be fun. That's a good way to start, too.
What I want to do with the frog's leg and the rice is to make one of the things that's standard for you, a prillo.
Yes.
And with, you gave me onions and garlic, and so sweat those in the pan, toast that rice in a separate pan, sear off those frog's legs, roast them in the oven with, honestly, probably a pretty good amount of garlic and a little bit of the lemon zest. Just with the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're ready to go, when they're probably medium well-ish, get them in the pan with the rice so that they finish and toss and get the flavor in there and get the last of the juice out of the frog's legs into the rice. And you gave me zucchini and radishes, just curls of zucchini, thin curls of the radishes with the butter lettuce and a lime vinaigrette and actually a lime and tomato vinaigrette. Use a little bit of that tomato. So I'm full of salads and frog's legs. All right.
One of the great things about frog's legs is when they're fresh, never frozen, from the United States, they're just so sweet. I mean, it's just a very surprising, wonderful sort of clean seafood flavor. I mean, they're just, and they taste like themselves. They taste like nothing else, but it's really mild.
Yeah. It's like,
I love frog's
it's
legs.
It's like getting fresh snake.
Oh, God. Whatever. All right. So, ooh, two trout. That's fun. Fresh corn, sweet red pepper. What are sweet red peppers?
Sometimes they're called bell peppers.
Oh, God. You know I don't like those. Walnuts, rice your choice, carrots, porcini mushrooms, chicken stock.
Yes,
wow, you gave me something
mushrooms.
I like.
Not a question.
Milk, butter, bay leaves, one green tomato, plain Greek yogurt. Wow, you gave me some stuff I like. Bartlett pears. What, there aren't any Oreos on here? Mature arugula. What's mature arugula?
Not little, tiny, flavorless baby arugula. Big, fat, thick, hot arugula.
Ooh, I like that. Okay, I want some hot arugula. 3-month Manchego and salami picante. Oh, my gosh. I love salami picante. That's thinly
all
sliced.
I all day.
I need some right away. Thinly sliced salami picante. 3-month Manchego is going to get just... out on the plate. What I'll do is I'll thinly slice it, and the mature arugula will make a great salad with the Bartlett pears as well. So this is going to become sort of an antipasta plate. I'm just going to lay out the Bartlett pears. I'll hit them with a little bit of fresh lime juice and just sprinkle a tiny bit of sugar on them, a little bit of salt and pepper, and then lay out the arugula underneath the pears. The Manchego on top, do a little julienne, actually, of the salami picante. And so that's that. And then
sounds like a high-quality salad to have with
a
beer and watch the football game.
I refuse to use the red bell peppers. So I know I'm going to get emails about that.
Oh, my gosh. What do you have against bell peppers?
I don't like the way they taste. I really, really dislike the way. All right, I'll use them. So I'll roast the red bell peppers in the oven. So I'll coat them with corn oil, salt, and pepper, and roast them at about 350 degrees until they're very tender. I want them super tender. And then I will open them up, take out the pith, take out the seeds, take off the stem, and discard that. And I will puree them in the blender with a little bit of, you didn't give me any, extra virgin olive oil, salt, and pepper. And
you can go to the neighbor's house and see
I'll
if you can borrow some.
I'll go next door and say, may I have some of this, please? And so, and then I will have to strain that because I want to make sure that every bit of the skin is out. Now, that just became the sauce foundation for my trout, which actually would be really, really good.
Once you know how I feel.
Well, but actually I do like them when they're roasted. And that's why I realized that I just don't like them when they're raw.
And you never change your mind.
I can't, and I will not saute them either. But if... Well, I always change my mind, and that's my prerogative as a human being, to change my mind. So the red bell pepper puree, it really needs that little bit. Either you need to finish it with butter, which you actually gave me, or the extra virgin olive oil. But because I'm going to serve it with the trout, I think it would be very pretty to finish it with that little bit of extra virgin. The trout head on, guts out, cleaned. Hopefully they have heads on. I'm going to saute them. I'm going to lightly dust them with flour, a little bit of salt, saute them until they're nice and brown.
Quick
and
technical question.
Corn oil.
What kind of pan and how hot?
Okay. I would.
Because people can get trout. There is nice rainbow trout available.
Oh, definitely. I would absolutely use a steel pan. It's got to be the right size because trout are pretty good size fish. They're 12 to 14 ounces usually.
Black steel pan.
Yeah, black steel pan.
Not a stainless steel pan.
No, black steel pan, but it's got to be bigger than the ones that I have where I cook every day. Our pans would actually not be big enough for a trout. Or you could use a stainless steel pan, but you better get that hot. You're going to have to get it hot and then coat it well with oil or the trout's going to stick to the bottom of the pan.
You'd use a cast iron.
I would not use a cast iron. So you brown the trout. Meanwhile, I would have roasted that corn in the husk, 350 degrees for about 30 minutes until you see that it's done. Take it, take the husk off, the silk off, cut it off the cob. And I like it in big pieces, so you don't have to break it up. Saute that. The rice, I'll just make the rice. I'll also saute the porcini mushrooms with that in the butter. The porcini's like the butter and a little bit of walnut at the end, and there you go.
Well, that's all for this episode of Formula Wolf on WYPR. We're out of time. If you want to reach us via email, it's formulawolf@wypr.org. You can go to the WYPR website and look up podcast on the Formula Wolf page and find this and all kinds of other episodes. If you want to follow us on social media, I am the real Tony Foreman. And Cindy?
On Instagram, I'm Chef Wolf. On Twitter, I'm Chef Cindy Wolf. Please follow me. I'd love to talk with you all.
Thanks so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.